Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and hashtag #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, listeners. You are listening to Military Money Monday on the Right Stream Network on Blog Talk Radio. And I am your host, John Gresham. This week, we are going to go and talk a little bit about the unknown heroes, the people who are in the military who maybe don't make the front pages of the history books, and maybe don't even make it into the history books, except in odd ways. But we're going to talk today about one of the most significant individuals of the 20th century U.S. Navy, a man who spent a career serving this country through two world wars, and had the unique distinction of being one of those rare individuals who was all about saving other members of the military. The gentleman we're talking about is Vice Admiral Alan Rockwell McCann, a graduate of the Naval Academy. He is best known for being the inventor, or co-inventor, depending upon some people's views, of something called the Rescue Chamber, and it bears his name. It is worth noting this was the only device which at the time was capable of going and providing a safe means of transporting sailors in a downed submarine on the bottom of the ocean to safety, and in fact was the first device that ever did so successfully. And we're going to talk more about that. His life story has been told in a great book from the U.S. Naval Institute Press called Pushing the Limits. And today we have the author of that book, Mr. Carl Lavo, with us to talk about Admiral McCann and his book and what it all means. And I'm hoping that you're there, Carl.
I'm here, and good afternoon, John.
It's good to have you with us today, Carl. First of all, tell us a little about yourself and how you became interested in Admiral McCann.
Well, actually, it was suggested to me by a reader of my former book, Back from the Deep. He's an Air Force veteran that lives in California, and he has had a lifetime interest in McCann, Alan McCann, and suggested that a book has never been done on his life history, and I should, he was suggesting I do such a book. I contacted the Naval Institute Press, and although they said that they were interested, they wondered where I would get the source information since he never left any oral histories. So I contacted Mr. Schism back in California. I said, well, this is what they believe. And he said, well, McCann was involved in so many unusual things that just telling the events of his life would be worth a book. And so that was my pitch to the Navy, and I thought, along the way, perhaps members of his family, his survivors, would fill in some blanks. They filled in a few, but not many. And it took me three years to research the book, actually 2 years to research it and write it, and then edit it following the submission.
And it should be noted, this was not your first rodeo with Naval Institute Press. You had done some other books with them, had you not?
Yes, I've done three previous books. I have a biography of Slade Cutter, submarine commander of World War II. Back from the Deep, which is the story of the Squalus sinking in 1939 and the rescue by the McCann Rescue Chamber. And also The Galloping Ghost, which is a story about Commander Flucky, who is a renowned submarine skipper and innovator during World War II.
So by this time, you had done a lot of work in and around both submarines and, interestingly enough, Admiral McCann.
Yes, quite a bit. in addition to working full-time as an editor for a daily newspaper, daily and Sunday newspaper in the Philadelphia suburbs. So it was a lot of work at both ends. Fortunately, I had a supportive family.
Yes, and Lord knows what we would do without those. And without further ado, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about Alan McCann. And let's start at the beginning. And as you point out in your book and the briefing you give on him, he came from a very American town, someplace called North Adams, Massachusetts. Talk about North Adams and talk about his growing up there.
Well, an editor told me once, to know the man is to know the boy. So I journeyed to North Adams, having never been there. And it is a beautiful town in the Berkshires, situated in a valley where there was a very rapid running river, the Hoosac River, with a lot of feeder streams. The highest mountains in Massachusetts are in and around North Adams. Nathaniel Hawthorne, the famous author in early American history, liked to vacation there, and he called it a peculiar place because it was hemmed in by mountains with no visible access way out, and it looked like a very peaceable kingdom in the village at the bottom of the hill. Well, the people in North Adams had granaries and mills powered by those streams, and they realized during the middle of the Industrial Revolution in the United States that if they could find some way to run a rail line to Boston, it would open up North Adams to the eastern seaboard and markets there, and as a transit point to places west. So the idea was to build a tunnel through Hoosac Mountain. This is a 5-mile-long tunnel, and it took them 25 years to build it with the help of state finances. A lot of deaths in construction of it, but when it opened, bingo, North Adams became this very prosperous town. The largest textile factories in the world opened up there, and the town soon became known for all of its mansions and high steeple churches. McCann was born into this setting on September 1896 to a Scottish tailor who had come to North Adams from Canada. And he went to work for a company, I think it was the Bolin Company, that was well known in New York City for fine woolen wear. And so that's generally where he spent his boyhood. But North Adams was kind of wondrous. It not only had this wonder of the world, the Hoosac Tunnel, which the kids would often look into, because at the very end you could see this very tiny little pinpoint of light. So you could see that it was a town of inventors. The man who invented the city streetcar system that moves on rails came from North Adams. They developed helium as a hot air ballooning mixture, and in fact, North Adams was once a ballooning capital. And they had a very famous school called the Drury Academy. It was a high school. It drew the best students from Western Massachusetts to it, and McCann graduated from the academy. Presidents McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt made campaign stops there, and McCann was among those in Teddy Roosevelt's visit to give them the Drury Yell. The Academy, which is a brownstone building about 3 stories high, was very well known throughout the United States. It taught oratory and critical thinking, engineering, and I think all those attributes went into McCann, making him a perfect student for nomination to the Naval Academy. Also, I would like to add that North Adams has a very illustrious military history in early American history. Several battles were fought around North Adams, and there were several heroes.
Okay, so we have this young man growing up in what would be considered an extraordinary place with all of these stimulations, all of this achievement, and this alluring and enticing tunnel to the outside world, and he goes to Annapolis. And talk a little bit about his time at Annapolis.
Well, he has a distinction even as a midshipman at Annapolis, because it was the quickest graduating class. In fact, he wrote a letter home on his graduation that this was the luckiest class. What had happened is the midshipmen came out early because the Navy needed sailors, and or rather officers, for a growing fleet, given that World War I was exploding and the United States had entered World War I. So they needed officers, and they needed them quick. So he graduated about 2 or 3 months early. And he did his early service on a battleship, the battleship Kansas, where he was an ensign.
And what was his experience on board the Kansas? Anything that was particularly formative or unusual about that experience?
I think probably he wanted to get into the war, but unfortunately the Kansas was served as a training ship, and it moved up and down the U.S. coast, but he never got overseas. And then
so
the
he
war
didn't
ended.
Get to go with Admiral Sims over to Scapa Flow.
No. And the war ended, and the Navy started demobilizing, leaving him with, what do I do with my Navy career now? I'm at sort of the bottom of the totem pole. And I think, although I don't know it for sure, but I know from talking to others, that the submarine service became more attractive. There's a couple reasons for that. One, it was a quicker path to command of a military vessel. And two, the Germans had shown how effective a submarine can be in wartime. And I'm sure McCann felt that, hey, this is the future, and I should get into it. And so he asked to be transferred to submarine training.
And this was a young man who clearly had come from a entrepreneurial community, and his education had certainly been technical and progressive. And so he goes and joins the submarine service. And what are his early experiences in the subservice? Where does he go and what does he do?
Well, he became executive officer on one of the lesser submarines after his training in New London, and he eventually rose to division officer in command of a fleet of R boats, I think about a half a dozen R boats.
This R boats 19... being a particular class of U.S. submarine at the time.
Yes, they're relatively advanced. But not in time for World War II. They needed even better submarines that could sail further. But McCann was skipper of the R-21 by 1924, and that was his flagship as commander of Division 1, a group of submarines deployed to the Panama Canal.
And what does his time in the Canal Zone do for him? Entice him to do?
Well, of course, being deployed to the Canal Zone was to put the United States in a defensive posture to secure the canal from attack from a foreign enemy. And the submarines were regularly patrolled back and forth from the Pacific to the Atlantic, with a base in on the East Coast and one Balboa on the West Coast. Of course, as people can appreciate, submarines were very, very dangerous in the 1920s, and disasters were fairly frequent. The submarines were thin-skinned, so any kind of collision with another ship usually ended up with the submarine sunk. In 1924, the O-5, which is an O-class submarine, was transiting across a bay on the east coast of the Panama Canal, and a banana freighter hit it, sinking it in 30 feet of water. Many of the men got off, Some on the bridge were thrown into the water. Others escaped through openings, and some were lost. But two were trapped, and they were trapped 30 feet down in the forward torpedo compartment. McCann, who was a skipper of the new sub, skipper of the R-21, was in port at the time, and he was among those sent to try to rescue or come up with some means of rescuing the people trapped in the O-5. What they needed to do, there was no way to get these men out. There was no vehicle you could send down to them to get inside of it. They had sent a diver down, and he worked his way through the wreckage and determined that two people were alive. He could hear their taps on the metal, but there was no way to get to them. They could, if he opened the forward hatch, for instance, water would just engulf them and drown them in an instant. So the only theory they could come up with for rescuing these guys was to get one of the big canal barges, the dredges that are used to carve the canal, have it brought down to the bay, and then have a diver go in, go down, hook a cable under the bow, and then lift the submarine up so that the forward hatch would be dry, and that way they could escape. Well, it took quite a while for the barge to get there. A landslide had blocked the canal. That had to be dredged out, but it finally made it with air running out for these guys. Diver went in, strung a cable under, had to tunnel through mud under the submarine to get the cable under it. And the first lift didn't work. He had to go back in and do it again. And finally, the crane was able to lift the sub just the last minute. And the two guys jumped out of that hatch, grateful to be alive. The diver that tunneled under ended up winning the Medal of Honor, or earned the Medal of Honor for what he had done.
And it should be noted, a successful rescue of a submarine on the bottom was and still is a very rare event. This was an extraordinary achievement for McCann and the people involved, was it not?
Very extraordinary, because mostly, the submarine service is known as the Iron Coffin Service by a lot of people around the world, because when there's an accident in a submarine, you don't come back, basically. There's a surface ship.
It's all or nothing in a submarine. You're either safe or you're dead.
Right. McCann, after this incident, ruminated on, what can be done to save these guys. I mean, these guys were only 30 feet below the surface. That's just one atmosphere's depth. It's not very deep. But the fact that they would be swamped by the water coming in the submarine, making it possible for them to escape, really bothered him. So he started sketching out.
I mean, the physics of what you're talking about are things that are taught to every scuba diver and free diver in the world today, how to make a free ascent from 30 feet. We all do it as part of our certification, yet in those days it was a difficult matter of physics and mechanics, correct?
Exactly. In fact, the air volume at depth expands as you rise. So as you know, being a scuba diver, that if you point your chin upwards, open your mouth, and let the air expel from your lungs as you rise, you can surface properly. But people tend to just not exhale that air, and it expands in their lungs, and that can cause problems and death.
Yeah, the technical term is pneumothorax, and what it means is the air sacs of your lungs simply explode and you die. So let's not kid ourselves. As you say, this was 30 feet. What would you do if you – I have to imagine he was ruminating on the problem of what happens if you lose a boat on the continental shelf a few hundred feet down. How could you possibly get men out of the boat and back to safety on the surface, correct?
Correct, and he came up with an idea for it, which he knew the Navy brass would consider kind of crazy, a development of a chamber, a pressurized chamber that can be lowered to either the forward or after hatch of a submarine. and make a watertight seal, then the guys could climb up into the chamber and then it could be pulled up to the surface. So he sketched out the idea with a cover letter and sent it to his division commander, and that was forwarded on to higher-ups, but nothing ever occurred. He never heard back on what the status of it was. Meanwhile, there was another guy in the Navy named Momsen, Commander Momsen, who had a similar idea, and he had passed it up, but again, there was no action. So time marched on. McCann was promoted to skipper of the new sub S-46, and he ended up in Pearl Harbor in 1927. And that's the beginning of another episode for him.
This is the Dole race disaster that occurred. A lot of people don't even know, along with the New York to Paris race, there was also a race from Hawaii to the West Coast, was there not?
Well, it's actually from Oakland, California, to Hawaii. James Dole came up with the idea of the Dole pineapple plantation. He was having trouble getting machinery equipment for his plantation, for his manufacturing processes in time. They come by a slow-moving steamer. And he felt, having read about Lindbergh, that, hey, if we could have air travel to Hawaii, that would open up tourism and also getting equipment quicker. And it's actually a closer distance than the one to Europe that Lindbergh flew by quite a distance, although there are no islands between Oakland and Hawaii to land on. So if anything goes wrong out there, you're in deep trouble.
Your navigation problem is significantly more difficult, because if you're flying westbound, you got to find a really tiny piece of earth out in the middle of a really big ocean.
Your navigation has to be dead on. Anyway, Dole put up a prize. I think it was $25,000 for the winner of a race to Honolulu and $10,000 to the second place. There were about a dozen flyers that eventually took off from Oakland in hopes of winning the prize. The reason he decided on a race is actually suggested by a journalist. The reason was that somebody else had actually flown to Hawaii from the West Coast, like months beforehand. So he couldn't posture it as the first one to do this. Instead, the journalist said, why don't you have a race? And, you know, a lot of people entered, and they were hopeful that Lindbergh would enter, but he had other obligations and didn't. However, they drew a carnival of planes, all different kinds of planes, experimental planes, to make this happen. Some of them crashed en route to Oakland with devastating effect. A couple pilots were killed. But nine actually were sanctioned to take off in the race. Three of them, however, ran into problems even taking off and never made it. The other half dozen were on the way. One of them drew a lot of attention because a young college girl by the name of Mildred Duran was a passenger with a pilot and his navigator. So as they made their way across country, they drew a lot of attention.
And as you say, a lot of these aircraft did not make it and crashed in the ocean along the way. And what was McCann's involvement in the search and rescue effort that followed?
Well, as you can imagine, the Dole air race drew a lot of attention, and the Navy volunteered to put aircraft carriers, destroyers, submarines out in and around Hawaii all the way out to San Francisco to effect rescue of any pilot that went down. McCann and the S-46 and some other subs were closer to Hawaii, where they felt that most of the planes might go in the drink because of running out of fuel or some other calamity. And so he was there as a lifeboat for any pilot who came down. Three planes were lost, including the one carrying Mildred Duran, and they set out to try to find them, but couldn't in the vast Pacific, and nothing has ever been found from those three planes. However, supposedly, according to Time magazine, there was a bottle washed up on a shore on the Oregon beach, and inside was a note saying, floating on wings, missed door, and then it ended. So the thought was that perhaps that plane did make a surface landing. They were floating on wings, but eventually sank, and there was just no rescue possible.
It was a hard business back in those days, to say the least.
Yes, and two of the planes did make it. Well, three or four of them did make it and earned the prize money. And, you know, even though there was a lot of jubilation, the fact that three others didn't make it, you know, was a set of grim scenario at the landing field in Honolulu.
And once again, here is Alan McCann out trying to rescue people. I mean, this is becoming kind of a central theme in his life, is providing options for survival where they did not exist previously.
Yes, and I think being in the submarine service, there's a lot more attention paid to that than maybe other services, because of the unforgiving seas and how to save yourself and how to save others. I think every submarine captain I've talked to and rate, they've always been very, very safety conscious and consider what can be done. And I'll describe a little of that when we talk about the Scuola sinking.
And let's go back towards the question of submarine rescue, because earlier you mentioned another person who was a truly great force for the idea of options for submarine personnel rescue, a gentleman by the name of Swede Momsen. Describe him a little bit and talk about the rather odd, I wouldn't call it a relationship per se, but the odd collaboration that developed between that very buoyant and public man and the much more reserved and quiet Alan McCann.
Yeah, Charles Momsen actually was nominated to the Naval Academy a year earlier than McCann, but he washed out. He got a second chance, I guess because of the contingencies of the war, and graduated behind McCann. So actually, though he was senior by age, McCann was senior by rank. Momsen, just like McCann, entered the submarine service, and he knew a lot of guys in the service. And in 1927, the S-4 was ran by a Coast Guard cutter off of, I think it was Cape Cod. And it sank, killing most of the men aboard and trapped six others. There was no way to reach them, and even though divers were sent down and could communicate with these guys inside through Morse code taps, they eventually suffocated. There was just no way to get them out. And then also that year, the S-51 sank off of Rhode Island after being rammed. Charles Momsen, commander of the S-1, was sent to the scene where the submarine was last reported, and he witnessed the rescue attempts, or vain attempts, to get these guys. Now, he knew a lot of the men in S-51, and they all suffocated, being unable to get to the surface. And it just boiled him, and he thought there's got to be some way to develop something to give these guys a chance. And he had this idea. He had this idea of a chamber, a rescue chamber, the one he had, like McCann, had submitted to his division commanders, but no action was taken. But he also thought of another thing, an air canister that could be strapped to your chest. and with a breathing tube. And you could actually, like, open the hatch, let the water flood into the submarine, and then ascend using this this air flask fueled with oxygen. And by a slow ascent, that is, letting your breaths exhale properly, you could make it to the surface. So there was no support for this, so he decided, hell, I'm going to do it myself. And so when he was transferred to shore duty, he started developing this apparatus, and he tested it out in the model boat basin at the Washington Navy Yard. And it was successful. And then he tested in the Potomac River. He went to this hole in the river that was about 100 feet deep, and he had a barrel, a waterproof barrel, inverted and lowered with him inside, standing on a wooden plank, to the bottom of the river. And then he ducked out from under the lip of the barrel and ascended using his lung. And he popped to the surface, fine as could be, clutching a rock that he had taken from the riverbed. And the event was chronicled by a reporter for a Washington newspaper. And so the story was in the paper, and Navy brass were angry as hell because of this unauthorized feat. But on the other hand, they were kind of proud of the fact that it was quite an achievement and offered some hope to submarine sailors.
On his own, Momsen does this very public, very flashy for the day thing, and probably gets spanked a little, but begins to draw on top Navy brass interest in the possibility that there were options to rescue downed submariners on the bottom of the seabed.
Yes, and Momsen at the time was at the Navy Bureau of Submarine Construction and Repair, and he noticed a dead-end file where papers had been shuffled for no action, and there were his plans for a rescue chamber. So, given the fanfare over the achievement in the Potomac River, he was called before Congress to talk about his what he had done. And the congressman asked him, you know, why this hadn't been developed. And Momsen mentioned he also had this other idea for a rescue chamber. And they asked him, well, what's happened with all that? And he said, well, nothing. And so Congress then just ordered the Navy to get busy, see what can be done, both at the rescue chamber and manufacturing the Momsen lung.
So all of a sudden, Congress gets involved. And how does McCann get involved in this effort?
Well, McCann is also in Washington. And as there were three plans for a Momsen rescue chamber developed, one by Electric Boat, I think it was, and two by his department. He was involved with the Experimental Navy Divers Unit in Washington. So there were three designs for this, and sea trials were about to begin when somebody in the Navy realized maybe it was Momsen, that McCann had a plan too. So they put McCann, they asked him to work together with Momsen on the sea trials. So they all went down this to Key West. These chambers were shipped down by train, offering a spectacle to people where the train passed, because they look very unusual on flatbed cars. They get to Key West and were taken out to sea, where a specialized submarine was positioned on the floor bed about 100 feet deep or so, and then they tried them out. Two of them weren't successful, but a third was, and it made connection with the submarine. They exchanged crews. The crews came up and down. McCann and Momsen both rode down to it, and up and back. So it was a success. However, there were some problems. The chamber tended to tip. It wasn't pressurized. McCann often thought that a pressurized compartment would prevent some of the decompression problems in rescuing submariners from depth. Also, there were two cables involved in the Mommsen version. One was a downhaul cable. The diver would leave the surface ship, take it down to the forward hatch of the submarine, and then the submarine would ride up and down on a second cable from the hatch. The trouble is those two cables could get intertwined. It did get intertwined, so it made it difficult. McCann's idea was there should be just a single cable, one to the top, the overhead of the rescue chamber, and another one from a winch from the bottom of the chamber. So a diver goes down with the cable from the winch to the hatch, and then the chamber is pulled down and seals around that hatch, and then survivors climb into the chamber, and then the winch begins letting out the cable, and the surface the winch on the surface ship starts winching it up. So the whole thing works well. Also, his idea was that it should be bell-shaped, so that the heaviest part of the weight would be in the lower chamber where it connects with the submarine, and then the upper chamber would be offer more ballast, would float more upright.
And this is state-of-the-art technology for the time. I mean, ocean engineering wasn't even a science per se at the time. So what he and Mommsen are doing and demonstrating at the risk of their own lives is pretty gutsy, pretty unusual for the time.
Pretty gutsy, pretty unusual. People throughout the submarine service in the United States were the happiest could be. This offered them two ways to save themselves, one with the breathing apparatus from Mommsen and other the rescue chamber. Now, the Mommsen flotation vest had already been coined by the popular press as the Mommsen vest, and the Mommsen lung, in fact. And so Mommsen said, well, this should be the McCann rescue chamber. And McCann, being very humble, said, no, don't call it the McCann rescue chamber. This is a Bureau of Development. It's the submarine rescue apparatus. So it just shows you his humility about any of his achievements. He's maintained that sort of stance career. Anyway, there were six McCann rescue chambers built, and one was stationed in New London, Connecticut, one at Key West, one in Balboa in the Panama Canal Zone, one in San Diego, one in Pearl Harbor, one at the Cavite Naval Station in Manila. So they were spread
out
across.
They're seated at strategic submarine bases all around the world.
Right, exactly. And furthermore, the Navy made the plans for the rescue chamber available to other navies of the world. Some adopted them, some did not. And those that did not ended up with submarine tragedies that could have been averted had they had chambers available, but much is life.
And we're going to talk about just how fast that rescue chamber went from questionable engineering achievement to something that today is nearly legend. We're going to take a quick break and run a couple of network messages, and when we come back, we're going to talk about something we call the Squalus incident, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's L-I-S-A-T-A-R-V-E-S. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book and my radio show, there are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
And welcome back. For our listeners who might want to talk to Carl, please feel free to go ahead and call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that number is 347-945-7246. And Carl, it wasn't a whole lot of time before Momsen, McCann, and their devices got the ultimate test, and that was the loss, the sinking of a state-of-the-art submarine, USS Squalus, SS-192. Please take us through the story of the Squalus sinking and the amazing efforts by the U.S. Navy and these two men to save a large percentage of that crew.
The USS Squalus was one of two submarines built at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard as a state-of-the-art fleet submarines. These submarines were unusual by world standards at the time. They were air-conditioned for one thing, because the Navy foresaw their use in tropical areas, particularly the Philippines.
These were very much the prototypes of the fleet submarines that we used to strangle Japan during World War II, correct?
Exactly. The idea is that they could travel with the fleet anywhere in the world, unlike the S-boats and the other classes of submarines. They were much more powerful. They had 10 firing tubes, 4 aft and 6 forward for firing torpedoes. A lot of innovation went into these things. Anyway, Squalus was one of the forerunners, as you pointed out, one of the newest. And it was on its certification dive. You had to make about a dozen and a half dives before you could be certified to join the fleet. And the certification dive was the last dive. This is a crash dive. You're going at flank speed, and you have to be completely submerged in a minute. The idea of being below the surface in 1 minute is that that was the if you could do that in 1 minute, a plane could not get to you and attack you. It would take more than a minute for an airplane to attack. So the idea is to get under within a minute. In that certification dive, they did get under within a minute. However, the induction valves, these are air-breathing tubes aft of the conning tower, which had closed, these feed air to diesel engines when the submarine's on the surface. The diesel stop, the induction tubes close over, airtight, and then you convert to battery power. Well, once they were under, mysteriously, the valves, the induction valves, reopened, and a Niagara of seawater poured into the after chambers. The commander, realizing the great jeopardy the boat was in, ordered surfacing, blow all ballast, pump air into the ballast tanks to get the sub back to the surface, and they almost made it. In fact, the tip of the bow came out, but the weight of the water in the after chambers dragged it back, and they just plummeted toward the bottom. People after the conning tower drowned, something like 26 men. 33 others.
Because the first thing you do when you have a situation like this is you close all the watertight hatches so that you isolate the flooding from the compartments that don't, that are not flooding.
Right. In fact, some of the people in the engine rooms were trying to get into the after torpedo room to save themselves. And I guess in keeping the door open, the hatch open too long, the water got in there and drowned them as well. But the hatch between the conning, the central control room, and the after mess hall was sealed in time, and 33 others were left alive as the submarine came to its landing 240 feet down on the bed of the ocean. Some of the survivors that I later talked to said that they were certain they were out over the continental shelf and it was doomsday. You know, they would be crushed at 1,000 feet or more. But fortunately, they weren't. They landed on the ocean bed at 240 feet down. They knew that a McCann rescue chamber was in near New London on a tugboat. They also knew they all had Mommsen lungs. Carl Bryson, one of the survivors, told me, you know, we had greased down. We were ready to come up on those Mommsen lungs. We knew we could do it. But Commander Cole at the Navy Yard in Portsmouth, he thought, this would be too risky. Rather, Captain Naquin on the Squalus felt it was too risky because the water was freezing cold. It was May, and it'd be better to wait for the McCann rescue chamber to arrive. He was pretty certain, the rescue attempt would get underway pretty soon, and they had enough air to last for a couple of days.
So, in addition, and by this time they had been located. One of their sister ships, the Sculpin, had come out and had found them. So what evolves over the next couple of days?
Well, once they were located, Sculpin radioed back to Commander Cole at the shipyard, and he right away, he called the dive unit at the Washington Navy Yard, headed by Mommsen, and asked them to be dispatched right away to Portsmouth to gear up for a rescue attempt. McCann was reached at the Bureau of Planning and flew up on a second plane with a bunch of other divers, deep-sea divers. McCann and Mommsen, by the way, had been working together on developing decompression tables for divers, which are in use today. So, Mommsen was in the first plane in, and went right to the rescue scene with some divers. McCann was in the second plane, but they got waylaid by fog, had to land in the Boston area, and then with a police escort raced up to Portsmouth. Many of the guys after arriving said, we've lived through everything, to live through that race up the coast. You know, they felt that they were risking their lives in the motorcade.
And
so meanwhile, the rescue chamber is 200 miles south, and Cole ordered it to get underway, and it came on a tugboat, which could only make so much. Other rescue vessels heading to the scene bypassed the tug, you know, zoomed up there.
The Navy was putting all of its chips on the table. They were going all in and bringing in all the expertise they could to do this thing, because very quickly this became one of the biggest stories of the time. It was covered by media in a fashion not unlike what we would see on CNN or Fox News today.
Yes, there was international coverage. And nobody ever had heard of in the popular press, the general public, and nobody had ever heard of a McCann rescue chamber. They knew nothing about it because it had not been publicized. And so the wait was underway. Families gathered at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard to wait the outcome. The first thing they did was bring tug to the scene, and it had to anchor over the submarine, directly over the submarine, using four-corner anchors so it wouldn't move. The worry about, they were pretty confident that the rescue chamber could work. What they were worried about is the weather. You know, if one of those nor'easters blew up off of Portsmouth, which was often, it could really complicate matters to the point maybe they couldn't rescue these guys. They knew that 33 were alive because the Sculpin had beamed down pulses in Morse code and had used an echo receiver to hear the hammer taps of the people below, and they were able to confirm that there were survivors down there and that the submarine was upright. That was important because upright, the chamber couldn't attach to the forward hatch.
So the circumstances of her sinking were such that she landed at an angle that could be worked with, at a depth which divers could go down and attach the necessary cables and attachments, and they could actually communicate with Commander Naquin and his people down in the submarine.
Correct, yeah. They did that through Morse code taps at first, but they brought in oscillators, which enabled better communication.
So how does it go? You've got the cables attached, the chamber's there. How does the rescue proceed?
Well, the first Naquin down below designates a party of six to make the first ride up on the rescue bell once it arrives. One was a civilian contractor. Others were injured in the accident. He felt that they should get up first. He also sent up his executive officer to give a full report on conditions below. The rescue bell descended right on, you know, as planned, and connected, and the guy, the operator, opens the hatch and climbs in and says, "Here we are, boys." It was like miraculous. And
I mean, it works just the way that Momsen and McCann had dreamed of, and they're about to do something nobody has ever done in the history of submarines. They're going to rescue people out of a downed boat.
Right, and the bell starts coming up, the anticipation mounts. There's a lot of media out there. They're all covering it, and it finally bobs to the surface in bright sunshine, and the hatch is open, and the first guy climbs out, and it was like stunning, something that's never been done ever in the history of the world. And the guy that first came out, the fresh air was so intoxicating, having been trapped so long down below, that he kind of fainted, had to be grabbed a hold of. Well, they brought them all aboard. McCann's role was to control the operation of the rescue chamber. Momsen's role was really, he was in charge of the deep sea divers. So, and they worked together. The bell went back down again, and this time brought up more than the recommended number, and it did so without any trouble. So McCann said, "Hey, you brought up too many," and he says, "But do it again," because they were anxious to get everybody out of there as soon as possible.
And let's face it, we're talking about the first operational use of a brand-new state-of-the-art system in seas that are not entirely friendly. So you can bloody well bet they wanted to get this over as quickly as possible and in as few trips as possible.
Right. One of the interesting things about the bell is that it had tin canisters shaped like stools, which was filled with water, about the weight of an average seaman. So when a survivor climbed up into the rescue bell, they would evacuate that water, and then he would sit there. So they would maintain neutral buoyancy by doing that. Anyway, they brought up another load of men, and that left eight, I think, including the captain. They went down the fourth trip of the bell went down, and everybody seated themselves in the chamber. They broke the seal with the submarine, and a winch started feeding out the downhaul cable, and it got jammed. And so the operator went back down, and it jammed, and it stuck, and there's the bell 150 feet below the surface, dangling on this line where it couldn't move up or down. McCann felt that here's the solution. We'll cut the downhaul cable. That way the bell would swing loose from the uphaul cable, and then we'll just pull it up. When a diver, one of Momsen's divers, was sent down to do that, he did cut the cable, and the chamber swung out into the ocean, actually collided with the conning tower of the submarine. One of the operators inside, boy, that's some story to tell your family. The first time in history a rescue chamber has collided with a submarine. Anyway, McCann ordered the uphaul to begin, and just as it began, the cable that was coming aboard, he noticed that it had frayed, and actually five of the strands of the cable had snapped, leaving a single strand. The feeling is that he ordered right away that the chamber be lowered to the ocean floor, like 300 feet down, next to the submarine, because something had to be done to risk that last strand separating, and then the whole rescue chamber would be lost. Could explode to the surface right through the hull of the rescue vessel, or be lost. So down it went onto the sub the seafloor, or the mud of the seafloor. This is, and while McCann huddled with others, Momsen and others, to figure out how we're going to do this, what they decided to do is that the operators would let off a little air from the compressed air to make the rescue bell slightly buoyant. And people above would then hand pull the cable in until they passed that frayed area. And so McCann would say, 2 seconds of air, psst, and it would rise a little. And then he'd say, you know, give another order. And it was very, very carefully, inch by inch done, until the frayed section of the cable was aboard. And at that time, they could start winding it in. But again, they had to control the buoyancy. They didn't come up too fast. So it was really a ticklish maneuver, but it worked. And everybody was rescued, captain, all the officers, and men that had survived the initial sinking. This was an unbelievable achievement. Around the world, there were headlines.
And needless to say, for the principals, including McCann and Momsen, there were rewards. There were accolades. They became the men of the moment, and some of the most, you know, well-known men on the planet for what they did.
Right. However, although there was universal acclaim, a court of inquiry into the sinking called McCann to talk about the rescue chamber development. And when he was asked whether there had been any official recognition given to him or Momsen, he said no. Right away, President Roosevelt righted that with a commendation for not only the rescue, but the salvage of the Squalus, which was returned to service as a ghost ship. It was reconditioned and renamed the Sailfish, inspired by President Roosevelt, who was a sports fisherman. And he said when the Squalus first was brought to the surface, it came rising up bow first. He said the photo reminded him of a sailfish, and that's what the Navy went with. The sunfish. They earned a distinguished record in the Pacific, by the way, and survived the entire war.
Though, ironically, it sank an aircraft carrier which was actually carrying the POWs who were survivors of the submarine Sculpin, which had found her on the bottom in 1939.
That,
you know, you can't write this stuff. You can't make it up. And of course,
it was the first time an unassisted submarine had sunk a carrier too. The Sculpin prisoners who survived that sinking and ended up in Japan were finally saved after the war. But the sailfish veterans and the Sculpin veterans see themselves as linked by all these events as one group. And so their reunion is
It's hard not to think of them together. And every submariner ever since then knows exactly who Alan McCann and Swede Momsen are, because ironically they still use a device very similar to the Momsen lung and train to use it. And talk a little bit about that ultimate irony that, what is it now, 75 years later, those rescue bells are still being used.
Yes, and most of the world's navies now conduct joint exercises every couple of years where they use all the different rescue apparatus. And they, like a Russian rescue vessel will be lowering a McCann bell to, let's say, a Swedish submarine. And they practice all these routines. And many countries, like the United States, have flyaway systems now that, you know, they don't have to station a chamber in any particular place. They just can load it up in San Diego and fly it all the way to the Far East in a hurry and get it deployed. So, yeah, but the McCann Rescue Chamber is still in service. The Italian Navy uses it. They had one from the Anteo lowered to a, I think it was a Russian submarine, to effect the transfer. This is a practice drill of quote-unquote trapped submariners back to the surface. And right there on the side of the bell is McCann. And this is just like, the picture I saw was taken just 3 years ago. So, yeah, the name lives on, the chamber lives on.
And the name McCann becomes part of Navy lore and legend. And yet, this was hardly the end of an amazing career, because let's fast forward now less than 2 years. And where is Admiral McCann, and what's he doing on December 7th, 1941?
Well, Commander McCann, he's on the submarine tender Peleus in the early morning at the submarine base. This is across the Sound from Battleship Row, and he's going through an Pearl Harbor. He's going through an exercise routine in his pajamas, a routine designed by ex-Marine and famous boxer Gene Tooney. As a Marine officer, he couldn't stand anybody with any belly fat, so he developed this routine to keep military men trim. And McCann followed this routine religiously, and also the Navy had adopted it as standard. Well, McCann was the sub-squadron commander for 12 submarines at the time, most of them deployed or in the West Coast. There were a couple in Pearl Harbor. He's going through his return routine on board the Peleus when he heard loud explosions, and he rushed outside to see attacks on battleships and explosions all around. He said, "It turned my stomach upside down. It's unbelievable." The Peleus commander was ashore, so McCann seized the moment, and he directed fire from the Peleus guns at the torpedo planes that were coming in and dive bombers. Also, submarines that were in berths were firing away as well. One dive bomber was brought down in combined fire from Peleus and subs anchored close by. After the assault and devastation, McCann directed rescue efforts to save men in Battleship Row, which was ablaze.
And so once again, he's at the right place. Some would say at the wrong time. I would say at the right time. But he's less than 500 yards away from Battleship Row when it's going up in smoke. He's ordering some of the first shots fired in the Second World War by Americans. And on top of which, he winds up sending his boats out as some of the first warships to go look and hunt for the enemy.
Right. The submarine force was the only Pacific Navy fleet still intact. The Japanese bombers didn't go after the submarine base or the oil tanks that were behind it. So it was important for the submarines, particularly the fleet submarines and the S-boats in the Philippines, to carry the war to the enemy, while the Navy rebuilt the rest of its fleet from the destruction not only in Pearl Harbor but also in Cavite and Manila.
And McCann has a wartime experience, a wartime career, that made him look a little like the mythical Pug Henry in Herman Wouk's The Winds of War and War and Remembrance. I mean, let's run down just quickly the various assignments he had, starting with the fact that he went down to Australia to go and help work with the submarine forces down there, and in particular with Admiral Ralph Christie.
Ralph Christie and Ian Lockwood for a time. The Navy had a lot of confidence in the submarines because they were very secret. They had very secret exploders in the torpedoes that operated on a magnetic principle. It was one of the biggest secrets within the military. All ships have a magnetic field under their bows, or under their keel. So the idea was that a submarine intercepting that magnetic field anywhere along the ship's periphery would trigger the nose cone into exploding under the keel, thereby, you know, one torpedo could sink a ship. That was the idea anyway. These were not field tested. They were only laboratory tested. And very few people in the submarine Navy even knew how they worked. They didn't want the secret of how they work leaked out. Well, but what you ended up with was submarines going into battle with duds for almost 2 years. Nobody could figure it out. Some people blamed the magnetic exploder. The Navy said, no, you have to keep using them. Some sub-commanders decided not to use the magnetic feature by disabling it, yet they were still having problems. A lot of subs were lost because they would get in there, fire a torpedo, hit an enemy ship, there'd be a clunk. That would, the track of the torpedo would lead back to the submarine, and the Japanese knew where to go to get them. So there was a morale problem building big time, particularly in submarines operating out of Australia.
So, inevitably, McCann becomes involved in the process of helping find out that there's not one, not two, but three layered problems which were making it so that our torpedoes were ineffective until the middle of 1943.
Yes, they were running too deep. That was solved. The magnetic exploder didn't work because of a latitude problem. The firing pin wasn't engaging. In fact, at one point when that was discovered, the all submarine commanders were told to fire their torpedoes at oblique angles at any enemy ship. You can imagine. That's the only way to sink a ship. It would be sort of a glancing blow. Well, eventually, all these problems were corrected. A fourth problem was circular torpedoes, which actually sank a couple submarines, and they altered the fins on the aft of the torpedoes in order to prevent them from circling back. But it took a while. A lot of submarines were sunk that needlessly shouldn't have been. And, of course, the Japanese thought at least in the early part of the war, thought that the American torpedoes were jokes. They'd laugh about them as they clunked off the side of their ships and sank.
And, of course, eventually, by September 43, the worst of the problems were fixed. New torpedoes were issued, including electric torpedoes, and at that point the submarine service enjoyed a renaissance when it came to the sinking of Japanese ships and merchant vessels.
Yep. they sank 55% of the Japanese military and merchant fleet. It pretty much isolated Japan, strangled them. Some submarine sailors I've talked to over the years say that there was no reason to invade Japan or even drop the atomic bomb because you could just wait them out. They were starving. They had no ships left. But again, after 4 long years of war, I'm sure many people wanted the war ended as quickly as possible. My father was preparing to invade Japan. He was on the destroyer Halford. He was in ships being mobilized in the Aleutian Islands to initiate the invasion.
Now, McCann had other incidents in his life. Excuse me, during that period. Well, just give me short explanations of some of the other things he did during World War II.
Well, he became commander of the battleship Iowa, and he was in the task force that bombed Okinawa, and then he was deployed to Leyte Gulf in the Philippines for the big landing in Leyte. So he was involved in the Battle of Leyte Gulf and was in the task force that Admiral Halsey was in charge of. And they were to guard San Bernardino Strait to keep Admiral Kurita's Japanese fleet from coming through and interceding in the troop landing on Leyte. However, for a number of reasons, Halsey went after some aircraft carriers, which actually were a decoy, to the north of Leyte Gulf, and for a period of time left the strait unguarded. After receiving reports that Kurita's fleet had been bombed and he had lost two cruisers and a battleship and was ineffective, well, Kurita put it back together and came through San Bernardino Strait and headed south to Leyte, and it could have been a disaster. But baby aircraft carriers and destroyers put up a fierce fight to the point Kurita lost his nerve and went back through the San Bernardino Straits. Meanwhile, Halsey was racing back when he had heard that Kurita was coming through, but by the time he got to the strait, Kurita had vanished. But anyway, McCann was in charge of the Iowa, which was one of the biggest, best battleships in the world.
Not a bad job for a submariner to get to command a state-of-the-art battleship. And then he gets an assignment which, unless you know what it was, looked totally bizarre. He got to command something called the U.S. 10th Fleet, which was a fleet with nothing but ships and only officers and a lot of very weird nerds and eggheads, particularly mathematicians. Talk for just a minute about that.
Yeah, it kind of reminds you of the NSA. It's a cyber command linked with intelligence people in England and the U.S. and monitoring all of the radio traffic from Nazi Germany, Japan, everywhere. They had broken the code, the military code of the Germans, and could read precisely everything that was going on. they used that information early on in the 10th Fleet's existence to defeat the U-boat attacks on convoys in the North Atlantic. And they used a method of carrier-based aircraft, destroyers, and of course, the land-based aircraft fanned out in arms that covered the ocean, like so that they knew where the submarines were coming through. And the minute one was detected, the others would pounce on it. And it was the end of the U-boat menace by late 1944. However, McCann was sent back to Washington to wind down the 10th Fleet, figuring the war was just about over. But then intelligence arrived that Hitler was striving for a last hurrah, and that is to send these newfangled submarines with snorkels. That means they could operate diesel engines below the surface without surfacing, and rather than battery-powered, so they could come up all the way across the Atlantic virtually unseen. So suddenly, McCann was in the position of stopping a phalanx of about 8 of these submarines from getting to the United States. And the fear was, what were they carrying anyway? Would they be carrying V-2 missiles? Were they going to attack New York or Washington and blow up some buildings? The Navy was so concerned that there was a press conference in Washington to just alert everybody to the possibility that there could be an attack and that buildings could come down, but it would not change the outcome of the war. So McCann was the operating commander of the 10th Fleet, and he was able to direct the deployment of aircraft carriers, destroyers, cruisers, anything that's out in the Atlantic to any particular spot. When the track of the Nazi submarines were detected, where they would be coming through south of Iceland and off of Newfoundland, he directed appropriate ships and aircraft to the area, and they got them all.
Not bad. Of course, who better to hunt a submarine than a submariner, as the British found with Sir Max Horton. So
yeah, what's interesting, too, if I might just interject, McCann was involved in setting up what was called Bermuda College mid-war. That was to train people that were involved with the 10th Fleet and how to hunt down submarines. What he did was his job was to collect a group of submarines, including captured submarines, and man them and deploy them in and around Bermuda, where these guys on the surface could test ways of finding them, locating them, and targeting them. So he had a lot to do with developing the strategy for how to defeat the U-boats. This is before he went off to Leyte Gulf.
Okay. And so Germany surrenders. And once again, as that man who always seems to be in the right place at the right time to see history made, he ironically is in Potsdam for the post-war conference between the great powers, Churchill, Stalin, and Harry Truman, now that Roosevelt had passed away. And what does he get to tell Harry Truman in July of 1945?
on the way back from the Potsdam Conference, McCann is the commander of the task force that took Truman to the conference in Europe and back. On the way back, he's able to relay information that the first atomic bomb had exploded over Hiroshima. That was a game changer for that ended the war almost abruptly. So there was a lot of jubilation, and Truman was completely ecstatic and couldn't wait. The task force made a record-breaking speed to get back to the United States so that Truman could hold a press conference and talk about it.
Now, after the war, he was one of the people who was absolutely a pioneer in operations of submarines in and around the polar regions, particularly the Arctic Circle. He had had some experience doing this during the interwar years, where he had helped do the conversions of a Navy submarine into something called the Nautilus, which was going to be used on a polar expedition. And in the summer of 1947, he comes back and does something called Operation Blue Nose. Talk a little bit about that and his dealings with a young Arctic scientist by the name of Dr. Lyons.
Yes, McCann was commander of all submarines in the Pacific after the war. And at the time in San Diego, there was a Navy scientist by the name of Waldo Lyon who was perfecting equipment to enable submarines to navigate under the ice. But what he needed was a submarine to test his equipment, and that included like a forward-scanning sonar, an echo sounder, topside, and a pathometer in the keel. He knew about McCann's involvement with the Nautilus in the first attempt to get under the Arctic ice pack. So he contacted him. And McCann, who had always been interested in Arctic possibilities for submarines, not only embraced the idea of donating a submarine, he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you a submarine, I'll give you an entire task force of submarines and a tender, and we'll go up there, and we'll use your equipment to take a submarine, the Boarfish, under the ice cap. Not only that, I'll go on the first attempt to get under the ice cap so that the skipper doesn't have to take the blame if anything should go wrong."
So once again, he's putting his own life on the line to go and try out new technology and a new idea.
That's correct. The engineer that he is, you come up with the idea, you see it developed, and then you want to try it, see how it works. So they get up, they go up to the Aleutian Islands, sail into the Bering Sea, and just above Alaska, they choose an area to sail under and use this equipment. So they go down, the Boarfish descends, and they keep the submarine midway between the ocean floor, which is very smooth at that point, and the ice cap. So there's like maybe 50, 60 feet clearance, top and bottom. They use this equipment to start going forward. Now, the QLA, which is this special device developed by Lyons, maps out through sonar what's coming, and also the upward scanning equipment maps the underside of the ice. What they discovered is that there are these gigantic ice pinnacles that hang down from the Arctic ice cap. So you have to depend on your equipment to negotiate between these ice stalactites that are hanging down. And
what they call pressure ridges, yes.
So you got the QLA, I think, is in the conning tower, and the other equipment is in the forward torpedo room. And Lyons later said that McCann and Captain Turner, the skipper of the submarine, were running back and forth between both, checking out the equipment as they go, you know, trying to be assured that things were going correctly. And they ventured 4 miles under the Arctic, under the ice cap, which is the first time that had ever been done. And it proved that submarine navigation under ice could be done safely. And that led to what we know today with nuclear submarines transiting the pole.
And there's a direct line between that particular operation and the early voyages of Nautilus, Skate, and Sago late in the 1950s, obviously.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And finally, maybe his last notable act, he winds up smack dab in the middle of one of the biggest fights, inter-service-wise, in the history of the U.S. military, something called the Revolt of the Admirals in 1949. Just give us a minute or two talk about his role in resolving that.
Well, there was a struggle after the war between the Navy and the newly created Air Force. World War II had proven the value of aircraft and strategic bombing. The Air Force had come up with a B-36 intercontinental bomber, and it pretty much could fly above any enemy attacks, and it could fly anywhere in the world. And it was much, much cheaper than what the Navy wanted to do, and that was build this super carrier called the United States. And outfit it with a 39-ship task force, that cost would be like $1.3 billion. The Air Force said, you can do this with B-36s. There's no need for the carriers in the Navy. Well, the Navy is very, very concerned because they could foresee them being reduced to a coastal defense force rather than this globe-spanning military arm of the government. The Defense Secretary Johnson, he ordered, finally after checking, what to do, ordered all work on the carrier stopped in April 1949. That decision was backed by Truman. This initiated what was, like you said, was the Revolt of the Admirals. There were lots of leaks of information that the B-36 was vulnerable to air attack, though the Air Force assured that they flew too high. There were also unconfirmed rumors that Air Force Secretary Symington had a financial interest in building in the B-36 bomber builder. Congressional hearings occurred. They're hunting out the source of the leaks. McCann turns out to be the Inspector General of the Navy at the time, and they wanted to hunt out the leak of this information, this scurrilous information, which the administration believed was inaccurate. And was proven to be inaccurate. And so the suspicion fell on the group called Op 23, which is the Public Relations Department of the Navy, headed by World War II hero Arleigh Burke.
Call CHINFO.
Right. Secretary of the Navy ordered McCann to raid the office, grab all the documents, see if it was true. Burke was tipped off that McCann was heading for his office. So his aide quickly gathered up some incriminating evidence, I guess, and made a beeline out of a second door as McCann came in the front door, bellowing, "Arleigh, it's a raid." And McCann ordered everybody to stay in the office as he and his deputies went through, gathered up information, interrogated them. They never found any incriminating evidence as far as I can tell.
Carl, we're coming to the end of the show. We've got less than a minute left. Give me a 20-second summary of what McCann was and who you think he was, and then we're going to call it a day.
I think McCann was a very dedicated, loyal Navy officer who did his best under all circumstances, tried to push the limits on all of his tasks, did what he could to improve the Navy, particularly the submarine service, and was a great hero of that time, but had been largely unrecognized.
Carl,
a humble man.
Thank you so much for your visiting us today. We're coming to the very end of the show. Take care.
Okay, thank you. That's that.